You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. What does drug withdrawal have in common with a broken heart? Why is the enemy of memory not time, but other memories? How can a blind person learn to see with her tongue? Why is the world's greatest archer armless? The answer to these questions aren't right in front of your eyes, but right behind them, in the 3-pound organ carried in the vault of the skull. The human brain has been a source of lifelong fascination for Stanford neuroscientist Dr. David Eagleman, who created and hosts the PBS series The Brain. And now he writes about the astounding adaptability of the human mind in his latest book, Livewired, The Inside Story of the Ever-Changing Brain. And today he joins me on the show to share how a child can still function with only half of his brain, how babies start modeling the world from the moment they're born, and what happens if those babies are deprived of sensory experience for the first few months or years of their lives. David also explains why the 16-year-old you and the 40-year-old you are like entirely different people, why we lose brain plasticity as we age, but how some parts of the brain fare better than others. He reveals what neuroscience can contribute to criminal law, how his company Neosensory is able to help a deaf person hear with a simple wristband, and how Elon Musk's Neuralink technology may one day help overcome certain injuries, but probably won't make you a super intelligent brainiac. Plus, he talks about what it's like to be a science consultant for HBO's Westworld, coming up with Dr. David Eagleman in just a moment. Dr. David Eagleman is a neuroscientist and internationally best-selling author. He teaches brain plasticity at Stanford University, is the creator and host of the Emmy-nominated television series The Brain, and the CEO of Neosensory, a company that builds the next generation of neuroscience hardware. The author of 7 previous books, he's out with his latest, titled Livewired, The Inside Story of the Ever-Changing Brain. David, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Well, I'll just dive right into it. I found this book so utterly fascinating. And it's just crazy to me because we know so much about space and physics and chemistry and the environment, but there's still so much about this thing that makes us conscious and allows us to figure out all of these other areas that we still don't understand. Is that one of the things that makes it most exciting for you as a neuroscientist? All the unexplored territory?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's why as a scientist, you go into an area where there's so much unknown. And fundamentally, this is about us. It's about who we are, why we think the way we do, why we have the beliefs that we have, and so on. And it's, in a sense, no surprise that there's so little known about it still, simply because of the complexity of what we're talking about. The human brain has 86 billion neurons. And each one of those is as complicated as a city. Each one of those is about as complicated as the city of San Francisco. It's got the entire human genome in it. It's trafficking millions of proteins around in very complicated biochemical cascades. And each one of these is connected to about 10,000 of its neighbors, which means there are, you know, hundreds of trillions of connections in the brain. And if you were just to take a cubic centimeter of brain tissue, there are as many connections in there as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So it's sort of not surprising that despite all of the incredible technology and progress we've made, it's still mostly we're just scratching the surface. Yeah. We're at the foot of the mountain on understanding the brain.
Yeah, and you get into some really interesting territory with the ever-evolving brain. The title of the book, Livewired, is actually a term that you coined yourself. What is livewire or live, you know, interchangeably, I think you use the term liveware. What do those terms mean?
Yeah, it's that in the field, we use the term plasticity. And what that means is the brain can change itself and then hold on to that change. And this was a term coined about a century ago. And that's why we call the material that we call plastic, that's why we call it that, because you can mold a plastic toy and it holds on to that shape. Well, that's great. That's one of the things the brain does. I assert, though, that it may be time that we outgrow that term plasticity, because what it implies is that you mold the brain into shape and then it holds on to that forever. And that's what it's trying to do. But in fact, your brain is changing every moment of your life. The thing is constantly in motion with this huge forest of neurons and their connections that I mentioned a moment ago. It's all alive down there. Things are unplugging and replugging and changing their strengths all the way down to gene expression is changing, biochemical cascades are changing. So it's a system that's constantly alive. And this is, of course, why we have memory, for example, because when you learn that my name is David, there is a physical change in the structure of your brain that allows you to remember that. So a month from now, someone says, hey, who did you do that podcast with? You say, oh, that was David. So, you know, our whole, every moment, everything you discover, every idea you have, there are massive changes. So I felt like, you know, I live in Silicon Valley where everyone talks about hardware and software all the time. But I realized that what's going on with the brain is not, it's not like that. It's not that you've got a hardware system with software running on top. Instead, liveware is the only term that I could derive that really captures what's going on, which is it's modifying its own circuitry on the fly all the time based on its experience. Wow. It's rewriting things all the way down.
Yeah. And I remember when I was in high school science class, I was taught sort of this rigid idea of the brain that there's a left brain and a right brain, and you know, the cerebellum is in charge of our balance and the occipital lobe controls our sight. The frontal lobe produces speech, as if the mind was balkanized and separated by these impenetrable walls. Turns out that's not really the case. Tell us about that.
That's exactly right. And that's a big part of the argument of this book, is that this textbook model that all students learn is wrong. This idea, like, okay, well, this is the visual part of the brain. This is for hearing, this is for touch and so on. I shouldn't say it's wrong. It's not that it's wrong. It's right most of the time. But what it overlooks is the fact that the brain is this enormously flexible system. So if something goes wrong with your eyes and you're not getting visual information in there anymore, then the visual part of your brain becomes no longer visual. It gets taken over. It gets encroached upon by hearing and touch and vocabulary words and math problems and so on. If you look in the brain of somebody who's blind, there's no visual cortex. It's all taken over. If you look in the brain of somebody who's deaf, the auditory cortex is completely taken over by other functions. Nothing lies fallow in the brain. It's like, you know, real estate in Manhattan or something. If something goes out of business, it's not like whole blocks just stand empty. Everything gets taken over. And so what that means is the brain is this dynamic, living, electric fabric. It's this very fluid system. And if you want to understand what's actually going on in the brain, that needs to be the first thing to start with, rather than learning all the sort of labeled areas and then later saying, oh yeah, by the way, this doesn't have to be the case. This can change enormously.
Yeah. And by way of example, you talk about a number of cases such as this armless archer who somehow holds the world record as the greatest archer. And you talk about a child who had a hemispherectomy, where the child loses half of their brain and is somehow still basically able to live a normal life as if nothing had ever happened. I think you said that maybe he has a slight limp and that's the worst of it. How is it even possible that a person can function with literally half of their brain?
So this is a big part of why I wanted to write this book, because we have no idea how to build machines like this. So yes, a child can get half their brain removed and they're just fine. All the functions that would have been in their, let's say, right hemisphere get wired up in their left hemisphere. And as you said, they have a slight limp on the other side of their body. And that's it. Otherwise, you wouldn't have any idea that they only had half their brain. Now, I cannot take my computer, my laptop that we're talking on, and tear out half the circuitry and hope that it's still going to function. Because we simply don't build machines that way. In fact, you know, engineers are praised for their trimness and neatness and efficiency and say, okay, here's the hardware. There's not one extra transistor here that's not needed. And here's right. the software that runs on top of that. And we're done. But that's exactly the problem, is that everything that we make is so unbelievably fragile. So by the way, at the end of the book, you know, I give this analogy of the wolf versus the Mars rover. So the Mars rover Spirit cost many billions of dollars. We sent it up to Mars and it did a great job there. But then it got its right front wheel stuck in the Martian soil and it died there as a result. It couldn't get out. And so it beamed its last swan song to Earth and died. And, when you look at what happens when, let's say, a wolf gets its leg caught in a trap, it chews off its leg, and then it figures out how to walk on three legs. Now, were wolf brains genetically predetermined to walk on three legs? No. Does it figure it out? Yes. It's an adaptable system that figures out what to do. If we could build robots that could figure out, oh, geez, I'm stuck. I'm going to chew my wheel off and then figure out how to operate this machinery differently, we'd actually have much more robust machines and save a lot of money and not have to have a multi-billion dollar piece of space litter on Mars now.
And recently, my wife and I just had a baby. So I've been thinking a lot about newborns' brains and how they work. And I know that other animals, as you discuss in the book, have a longer gestational period. So they sort of come out more fully formed. You know, for instance, I think zebras and horses are able to walk straight out of the womb. But human babies enter the world with much more of a learning curve ahead of them. And I wonder if that's actually, in some ways, an evolutionary advantage that we're not so fixed. And we are born with that ability and really the imperative to take in new data and model the world around us.
So your baby wasn't walking in 45 minutes?
My baby's still not walking. And we're at 6 months. So, but
yes. Exactly. So this is the thing. Yeah. So it's about 45 minutes for zebras, horses, giraffes to get up on their little wobbly pencil legs and start moving around. And you have noticed that it's not the same with Homo sapiens. And so this is because we represent the highest degree of a trick that Mother Nature has pretty recently discovered, which is instead of building a brain that's completely hardwired and ready to operate in the world, you put out human brains half-baked so that they drop into the world. They have this incredibly long infancy, but what they're able to do is absorb the world around them, the culture, the language, the belief systems, the technology, all of that gets absorbed. And that trick has worked wonders. Humans have taken over every corner of the planet. We've gotten off the planet. We've invented the internet. We've done a million things. And it's because we are the only species that is as plastic as we are.
And I wonder what would happen if a newborn were kept in the dark, in a silent, empty room for those first few months or years of their life and deprived of any kind of sensory input other than, you know, I guess, nourishment. Would their brain remain only half baked? Could they catch up or would that damage just be permanent?
Yeah, unfortunately, we have these natural tragic experiments where there are some children, happily, this is very rare, but there's some children who are so severely neglected because their parents have some kind of deep problems going on. And so the child is locked in a room. They're not given any attention, any speech, any love, any touch, things like this. And these kids come out severely deprived. And it's because what I mean is that they come out with severe cognitive deficits. Mm-hmm. And it's precisely because the gamble that Mother Nature takes is, okay, I'm going to put this in the world half-baked, but I'm going to assume that the child is getting all the proper inputs and then their brain's going to wire up and be terrific. But if not, then it's a real problem. And by the way, this happened also with Romanian orphanages after the fall of Ceausescu,
right,
because there ended up being tens of thousands of kids whose parents had been killed. So they ended up in these orphanages and the staff was overwhelmed. So the staff decided, all right, look, the only way this is going to work is if we don't talk to the kids and we don't touch them, because if we do, they'll get clingy. And so that's what they did. And all of these kids ended up with severe cognitive deficits for precisely this reason. They weren't getting the proper input that a child's brain expects.
And yet, if you take a fully formed adult and put them in solitary confinement for a year, or blindfold them and deprive them of their senses, somehow they still manage to adapt. Why is that?
Yeah, well, this for two reasons, two things I should say about this. One is, as you age, the plasticity of the brain diminishes. So you become less flexible. Really, the job of the brain is to make a good model of the world. And as you live life, you make a better and better model of the world. And as a result, things get more and more cemented into place. And it becomes harder to change that model. Now, that said, it is very terrible and damaging in all kinds of ways for adults to be in solitary confinement. But it's not for the same reason. Mm-hmm. They've already develop the skills and the language and the other things that they need. It's just psychologically damaging for other reasons. Because we're such intensely social creatures, which is what we're all experiencing during COVID lockdown, by the way, is the same issue that, you know, I have two kids myself, and they seem to be doing fine with lockdown in the sense that kids don't know that the world is supposed to run differently. So they're just doing their thing. But it worries me that they're not getting the kind of social input that kids their age are supposed to be having.
Yeah, certainly. But in a way, do you think it's a good thing that the pandemic has sort of knocked us off of our hamster wheels and we can't operate on autopilot anymore? We're having to figure new things out. And, you know, sometimes just out of boredom, you know, people are taking on new hobbies and learning new things, learning a language, that kind of thing, keeping the brain a little sharper than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the fact is that as we make this internal model of the world, what we do as we age is we get more and more efficient at operating on this. And we say, okay, I got this. I've got all this burned down into the circuitry of my brain. I know exactly how to operate. And as a result, we're not challenging ourselves as much and we're not having as much brain plasticity. And what happens with lockdown, what has happened is suddenly the whole world is forced into a new era of rethinking everything. So we're all off of our path of least resistance. And, you know, that comes with plenty of stress and anxiety, of course, but I think it's a really great, useful thing. I actually have a suspicion, although this will be hard to prove for a long time, but I have a suspicion that there will be less dementia when our generation becomes quite old, just because we had this chance in the middle of our adult lives to really rethink everything and think, oh my gosh, this is not the world as I thought I understood it. I have to figure this out again.
And now, do you do that trick where you use your left hand to do a lot of everyday tasks? And does that actually work? Does that rewire the brain?
Yeah, in a very minor way, but sure. Mm-hmm. I try to always do things in a novel manner. So brush my teeth with my left hand, shave with my left hand, use my mouse with my left hand, things like that. But also things like driving a different route home from work every day. Mm-hmm. I always try to do that, at least back when we used to drive to work. And you know, otherwise, because you've noticed that if you drive the same route home from work every day, the perceived amount of time it takes shrinks and shrinks until, you know, it starts feeling like, oh, I left work and then I was home. And it's because what we've done is we've automatized the behavior so much that we're not noticing anything and we're just unconscious zombies when we're driving. Mm-hmm. And so I always try, you know, and this is not, of course, a way to live longer. It's just a way to make it seem as though you are living longer is to constantly seek novelty and constantly challenge yourself. This is the most clear, important lesson that has emerged from neuroscience as far as what to do for ourselves as we age, is to make certain that we are constantly challenging our brains, doing things that are frustrating but achievable. You know, a big problem, as we all know, with, you know, parents or grandparents or seeing other people retiring, is people often retire and their lives shrink and they're not pushing themselves to make new roadways in the brain. But this is the best thing that you can do for your brain.
Do you find that you do that often? You sort of become the subject of your own research. You maybe analyze your thoughts and try to catch yourself or figure out why you perceive something a certain way. Does that follow you home a lot?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my wife's a neuroscientist, too. So we're constantly doing this. The funny part, though, I have to say, the funny part is, although this is what I study day in and day out, every day, and I write books all night on this stuff and so on, our psychology puts up, you know, pretty strong fence lines around things. So one doesn't, how do I put this? No amount of knowledge affects your day-to-day behavior. Just as an example, like, I'm well aware that colors don't exist. All you have is electromagnetic radiation in the world of different frequencies, and our brains cook that up and make this way of summarizing information by perceiving color. Does that change anything about me looking around the room and saying, well, that's clearly blue and that's red and so on? No amount of academic knowledge on that changes my perception of the thing. And this is true more generally when I feel, you know, angry or sad or happy or whatever. Even though I know that these processes are happening, I still feel as though that's what I'm experiencing.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. What you deal with in this book, really, it sort of alters our concept of self, because, you know, we think of our 16-year-old self and my 46-year-old me as the same person, but in so many ways, they're like entirely different human beings. I mean, who knows if 46-year-old me would even like 16-year-old me or vice versa? You always hear of couples who marry one person and then 30 years down the line, they find that they can't stand each other because they've become such different people.
Yeah, exactly. This has been a theme that I have loved my whole life. I don't know if you know, I wrote a book of fiction called Sum, S-U-M, some years ago. That became an international bestseller, and it's in 33 languages. Sure. But one of the stories was exactly about this, about how in the afterlife, you're broken up like light through a prism into all of your different ages. And the, you know, the expectation is that you're going to get to really understand yourself at these different ages. But what happens is that your 7-year-old self doesn't really want to hang out with your, you know, 62-year-old sure. self, and your 40-year-old self has different things going on, doesn't want to spend time with you. And so what happens is everyone ends up going and finding other people their age, and they want to hang out with them. And once a year, everyone gets together for what's like a family reunion. And, you know, the young people sit, listen to stories told by the old people and so on. But in fact, you were all of these ages, but you're not really represented by any one of them.
Mm-hmm. And this sort of gets to something else that's a big passion of yours, which is the emerging field of neural law. We have this problem where judges don't consider why someone committed a crime and try to figure out how to course correct. It's just all about punishment all too often. Tell us a little bit more about what you're working on there.
You know, one of the things that's hard to ignore, you know, there's a lot of great stuff about our system of criminal justice, but we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. America is number one in the world in terms of the percentage of our population that we put behind bars. And the thing is, this would be okay if it was solving something, but about a third of the prison, or 30% of the prison population, has mental illness. And the reason this has happened is because, you know, we deinstitutionalized our mental health care hospitals back in the 60s, and that whole population flowed into the prison system. And it turns out it doesn't actually help anything to take someone who's mentally ill and incarcerate them. Mm-hmm. Same with drug addiction. Our prison population has gone up eightfold since the war on drugs was declared in the 70s. And the fact is that if somebody has a drug addiction, you can't fix that addiction by just sticking them in jail. It is a brain problem. Attacking drug supply doesn't work at all. You have to address drug demand, which is the brain of the addict. And in neuroscience, we understand so much at this point about the circuitry and pharmacology of drug addiction and how to address it. And so there are all these examples of things where incarceration, which is a perfect solution in some cases, is not a perfect solution in other cases. And so, you know, one of the simplest steps that counties and other jurisdictions can do, which I've been a big proponent of for many years now, is setting up specialized court systems where you have specialized courts that where the judges and juries have knowledge in, let's say, mental health or a specialized drug rehab court and so on, so that instead of just saying, okay, we're going to assume that everyone who shows up in front of the bench is the same and they all should get 3 years in prison, In fact, recognizing that brains are very different from one another, and it doesn't let anybody off the hook to make this biological understanding a part of it. Instead, it just roots people forward differently through the system.
Mm-hmm. But it also seems that beyond that, we need to break free of kind of this categorization where we consider a criminal either sane, insane, or temporarily insane, because there's so much more in between the lines there, isn't there?
Yeah, although I would say, thank goodness we at least have that.
Right.
At least the notion that some people we say, wow, they are so different that we have to have a category and say that they're criminally insane.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually was introduced by the ancient Romans because they recognized, wow, you know, we want to treat everybody exactly the same, but some people are really, really different. There's something very different happening in this person's mm-hmm. brain. And I, of course, agree with what you said, which is the key is to get that even more refined mm-hmm. as we move forward.
Well, David, my wife is actually a lawyer, and she insisted that I ask if you ever do expert witness testimony.
You know, actually, it's funny.
Do you ever do that?
I actually have specifically not done that.
Oh, yeah.
Because it asked by both prosecution and defense to do that. But I am the executive director of the Center for Science and Law, and I want to make certain that I don't. Mm. I've seen some of my colleagues do this, and they end up on some high profile case, and then it makes it seem as though they are, you know, in favor of this kind of thing or in favor of that kind of thing, depending on which side they're asked to testify for. So
okay.
At the moment, anyway, I have not done any expert ones.
Well, I want to get back to talking about how our brain ages and how plasticity diminishes and how that factors into dementia. I've heard other neuroscientists refute this idea that dementia is just this gradual degradation of the brain, but more a case that by the time that we're 80 or 90, our brain has just taken in so much more information than, say, a person in their 20s, that it's sort of a form of data overload. What do you think about that hypothesis?
I don't buy that for one second. here's why. I mean, so let me say like three things on that. One is the brain is so different from a computer that we don't store things like files where everything takes up space and so on. You know, I teach medical students and they often will say things to me like, I'm afraid that if I learn one more thing, something else is going to fall out of the brain,
right?
Which is hilarious because that's not actually how the brain works. What we do is we build models where each new piece of data fits in to, you know, you learn one more thing, you think, oh, I get it. That ties these things together mm-hmm. and so on. So it's not that we have any sort of limited capacity. The problem with dementia, of course, is not really the issue of can I learn new stuff or is there not enough room? The issue is, you know, I can't remember what I did last week or last month or last year. I'm forgetting people's names. I'm forgetting my children's names. This sort of thing is what goes on with dementia. And so what's actually happening there is a physical degradation of the tissue, so much so that we can see it with the naked eye, that the tissue is degrading, like in, you know, frontotemporal dementia, for example. You can just see the frontal and temporal lobes degenerating. Here's the really important part, though, which also, by the way, disproves this idea that it's just data overload. It's that there have been some long-term studies now of people that have stayed cognitively active till the last days of their lives. And it turns out that at autopsy, it's sometimes discovered that these people had Alzheimer's disease, but nobody knew it. No one knew it because they didn't have any of the cognitive deficits. And what's going on is even though the Alzheimer was physically ravaging their brain tissue, they were constantly building new roadways. They were making new bridges all the time because they were constantly challenged with, you know, social things and having responsibilities and having to figure out some new thing and how to send a text on a phone and whatever. And as a result, even as, you know, lots of roots were falling apart, they were building new roots all the time. Mm-hmm. And that is, as I said, probably the most important lesson we have coming out of neuroscience about how to prevent the cognitive effects of dementia. I wish it were something like, oh, just eat this pill or eat this kind of fruit or something. But instead, it's just stay cognitively active.
Yeah. So we've established that plasticity diminishes as we age. But you say in here that different parts of the brain diminish at different rates. Malleability is not fixed across all areas of the brain. Give me a couple examples of an area of the brain that's highly malleable versus one that isn't.
So it turns out your visual system locks itself down pretty early on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, so what I suggest in the book is a new hypothesis about why this is. And I think it has to do with the variability of the data. So what I mean is With vision, you only have a certain number of angles in the world and shapes and movement and direction. And so your visual system ends up saying, okay, I got this, I'm locking down. In contrast, something like your motor system ends up being flexible your whole life. Why? It's because you grow, your body changes a lot from infancy to adulthood. And then during adulthood, you get fatter and skinnier. You get on a bicycle, you get on a surfboard, you get on rollerblades. All your motor system is constantly having to work to figure out, whoops, okay, how do I control this body now? And as a result, it stays flexible essentially your whole life. So it's very difficult to get somebody's visual cortex to change when they're an adult, but the motor cortex is always changing.
So our concept of our physical body is not innate. It's not fixed. It's entirely learned throughout our life.
Yes. Well, this is one of the things that I demonstrate in the book, is that typically people have thought, oh yeah, well, this must just be fixed. So in the 60s, it was discovered that there's a map of the body in the brain. In other words, if you put a little electrode in and zap at different spots, you find, oh, the person twitches their hand here and their leg here and their, their cheek here. And what you find is that there's a map of the body in the brain. And so then the first assumption was, wow, that's cool. That must be genetically pre-specified. But it turns out it's not, because if you, let's say, lose an arm, then your map changes. The map of the body changes. And so what this means is it's not pre-written. And by the way, we see things. One of the examples I give in the book, and I show videos of this because I find it so stunning, is this dog named Faith, who happened to be born without front legs. And so she just walks bipedally. She walks on her back legs. And it's really amazing to see, wow, a dog walking around like this.
Yeah.
But it's not that hard for her. She just figured it out. Why? Because she was motivated. She needed to get to food, to water, and so she figured out how to walk without front legs. And wow. So what this tells us is, this means that the dog brain is not pre-programmed to run a dog body with four legs. The dog brain is simply pre-programmed to say, get what you need and figure out what you need to do to get there.
That is so fascinating. So if the brain is not fully pre-programmed to run a particular body, what could be the role of virtual reality and robotics in altering our sense of the physical body and reshaping how the brain adapts?
Yeah. So people have already been putting robotic arms on people who are fully paralyzed. This work started about 10 years ago, and it's incredible work. So there's a woman named Jan. I have a television show called The Brain on PBS. And I covered her story. If anyone wants to see the video of this, she's totally paralyzed. And she went in for a surgery where they just implanted some electrodes into her motor cortex. And then she can control this beautiful robotic arm with it. And the robotic arm, by the way, is all the way across the room. So she's sitting there in her chair and she's controlling this arm. And she gets better and better at it, in part because the engineers are making the arm better and learning how to read her brain signals better, but in part because of plasticity. She's just learning, okay, if I wanted to really grasp finally there, I have to sort of think this. I have to move the arm this way. So both sides are figuring out how to make the arm better and better. But the point is, it's actually, in retrospect now, trivially easy to add a robotic arm to somebody. And then in virtual reality, you can do things like, oh, here's a game where I'm adding a third arm. So my colleague Jeremy Balinson at Stanford has this VR experience where you, with your two arms, are controlling, you're holding onto controllers with both arms and you're picking some boxes and so on. But you also have a third arm coming out of your chest, and you control that by tilting the controllers in a particular way. And it does not take long at all. It takes about 3 minutes for people to get pretty good at controlling this third arm. Which just, again, demonstrates how flexible the system is. It says, oh, I see. I happen to be in a body with three arms. No problem. I'll figure out how to drive that.
That is mind-blowing. And I don't know how silly we can get here, but if we were either virtually or robotically placed into the body of something wildly foreign to us, like, say, a spider or a snake or a bird, could we adapt and learn to function fairly quickly?
Oh, absolutely. And this is what happens when you learn a new... a pogo stick, what do you call it? Parasailing one of these surfboard things that's new. You know, that is exactly what's happening. You take a bicycle, which you probably learned as a little kid, right? You get on that, evolution never foresaw the coming of wheels, but you have no problem saying, oh, okay, let's see. I do this. When I want to stop, I squeeze my hand. When I want to, you know, turn the corner, I tilt my torso and so on. You just figure this stuff out quite easily. So the body of another animal would be no problem at all. I mean, people get in these big mech suits. I don't know if you remember the end of Aliens where, what's her name? Ellen Ripley. I can't remember actually. Susan Sarandon, was that her name?
Right. Sigourney Weaver, I think, right?
Sigourney Weaver. Yes. Thank you. Sigourney Weaver gets in the mech suit and she moves this giant thing around and she gets in a fight with the alien and punches the alien in the head with this. But that's the fact that we can use mech suits like that is just because it doesn't, your brain doesn't care what kind of body it's controlling. It just figures out the correlations. It says, oh, I see. When I do this, that happens. Okay, got it. When I do this, this, that happens. And it figures it out.
Wow. And you actually discuss in the book the fact that you've fairly recently expanded beyond research and academia into the for-profit tech world, founding your own company, Neosensory, which is putting a lot of these theories into practice in ways that could be useful, especially for people who have some type of injury. What kind of things are you working on at Neosensory?
Yeah, here's what we're doing. We have a wristband with vibratory motors in it. And so it's about the size of a Fitbit. You put it on and it can translate any kind of data stream you want into patterns of touch on the skin. And so our main market right now is with people with deafness or any degree of hearing loss. We capture sound and turn that auditory world into patterns on the skin. And people who are deaf can easily learn how to hear through their skin. Now that sounds weird, but all your inner ear is doing is capturing vibrations on the eardrum and then breaking that into frequency and sending spikes to the brain. We're doing the same thing. We're essentially just transferring the inner ear to the wrist, breaking things into frequency that gets put on your skin, that climbs up your arm and up your spinal cord into your brain, and your brain figures out what to do with the information. It doesn't have to come into the auditory cortex. There's nothing special about that part of the cortex, except that happens to be where the data cable from the ears gets plugged in. And so it can go into a different part of the brain, and the brain is really good at figuring out correlations and patterns. So you know, a deaf person looks at the dog's mouth moving and feels the patterns on the skin and eventually puts those together, is able to understand what's happening in the auditory world that way.
Wow. So the brain completely bypasses the whole auditory system and it's interpreting those vibrations directly. It kind of cuts out the middleman, huh?
Well, exactly. It is because the brain is the cortex, which is the wrinkly bit on the outside of the brain.
Yeah.
That's a one-trick pony. The cortex everywhere has the same circuitry and it gets defined by what data cable you plug into it. So, oh, here's visual information. Great. I'll become visual cortex. Here's auditory information. Great. I'll become auditory cortex. But this is actually the thing that, you know, that we started talking about at the beginning. That I think is the right way to look at this technology is understand, oh, okay, it will get defined by whatever you plug into it rather than, oh, this is fundamentally the visual cortex. And by the way, this is not just speculation on my part. You know, there's a group at MIT who's done studies where they take the visual data that would normally go to the visual cortex and they reroute it so it plugs into the auditory cortex. They do this in animals, not humans. And then what we would have previously called the auditory cortex now acts like visual cortex, because it's not fundamentally auditory cortex. It just happens to be the information that it was getting. Now it's getting visual information. So it's all very malleable. And this perspective is what allows us to, you know, I gave a TED talk on this a few years ago and, you know, I've always been an academic my whole life, you know, running a research lab. But after the TED talk, a number of VCs came up and said, hey, we want to fund this as a company. So I ended up spinning a company out of the lab on that. And it is tremendously satisfying to me that now we're on wrists all over the world. And deaf people all over the world are having their lives changed by this. And so, you know, this is something you can't really do in academia, is actually change people's lives like that. And by the way, if I can just say one other thing. So in this part of, I know you know this about it. So that's one of the things we're doing is for deafness. But in fact, you can send any kind of data stream in there. So we've done, for example, an infrared version. So you're picking up on infrared light. And, you know, the first night that I wore this, you know, I was walking in the dark between some houses and I suddenly felt a bunch of infrared and I thought, what's going on? So I followed my wrist and I came across an infrared camera, you know, a night vision camera, which is normally completely invisible to us because it has infrared LEDs casting light. But, you know, it was totally obvious for me. It was right there. This is the kind of thing it opens up a completely new world for us when we can tap into other data streams. We've tried all kinds of things. We're in the process of trying all kinds of other things with, you know, Twitter, stock market, drones, all kinds of data that you can feed in and develop a direct perceptual experience of it. Mm-hmm.
Today's Friday, the 28th, and I do want to talk about Elon Musk because later today he is supposed to make a big announcement about his company Neuralink and what they're working on. Supposedly, he may even give a demonstration of how this technology of brain weaving might work to digitally enhance the brain. There's supposedly potential to overcome Parkinson's, paralysis, maybe even make us super intelligent and be able to download and upload unlimited amounts of data into our brain. Do you consider Neuralink a competitor to Neosensory? And what do you think more generally of what he's doing there?
Yeah, it's not a competitor because what we're doing is we're feeding information to the brain in a non-invasive way for a few $100. Okay. You have this wristband, you can feed anything you want. What he's doing is putting a high density of electrodes into the brain, which by itself is nothing new. The new part that he's doing is Neuralink has developed this way of essentially sewing the electrodes in there. So you get a bunch of electrodes in there, right where you're sewing. I'm super interested to hear his announcement later, and maybe this is goofy for me to make any statements before I hear what the announcement is, but what they're doing is going to be super useful for various disease states, as you mentioned, clinical things. But the idea of, oh, we'll be able to download information to our brains, I think is not likely to happen, certainly not for the foreseeable decades. And here's why. It's because in order to sew the stuff in, you need to drill a hole in the head and sew into a particular spot in the brain. But in fact, everything interesting that your brain is doing needs the whole brain involved, not just one tiny spot on the surface of the brain. And so beyond that, neurosurgeons are not going to do these surgeries because there's always some risk of infection and death on the operating table. Sure. And consumers, like let's say I want to text with my phone a little bit faster, I'm not going to go in for an open head surgery in order to be able to do that. And so I'm super interested to see what he announces this afternoon, but that's my pregame on it.
Yeah, there is a risk versus reward component to it. And you know what doctors always say? They say, once you crack the skull open, the brain is never the same. So I also want to talk about AI before we go. How live-wired is artificial intelligence right now? And is that the key or the breakthrough that needs to happen for a computer to be able to mimic the brain's plasticity before machines can really achieve general intelligence or true AI?
You know, it's interesting because current AI has taken off from a very basic understanding of the brain. And by very basic, what I mean is AI says, okay, look, imagine you have these units and these units are connected to each other. And then AI went off in its own direction. And it can do some really, really impressive things right now with superhuman performance on particular things. But it is nowhere near as smart as, you know, a three-year-old kid who can walk around and do all kinds of things and socially manipulate adults and navigate a room and get food to her mouth and do 100 other things. And so despite all of the hype about what's going on in the AI world, the way we currently build it is still quite stupid in the sense of being very limited, in the sense that I can make an artificial neural network that can discriminate pictures of cats and dogs, you know, better than humans can. But if I then say, okay, now can you tell the difference between, you know, camels and penguins, it'll fail catastrophically because it's trained up on this one thing. It's no good at going to a different thing. So there are lots of things to be done still in the AI world. I think, you know, AI in a sense, one of the things it did take from neuroscience is this notion of plasticity. So it's constantly changing its connection strengths. That's what it's good at. But it's not doing anything more sophisticated than just that. And the last thing I'll say on this is in current AI, all that's worried about is, hey, these are the units and these are the connections between the units. So I'm going to strengthen the connection or weaken the connection. But in fact, in the brain, it's much more than just the synaptic strength, the strength of the connection between neurons. There's all kinds of stuff happening inside the cell, including the distribution of the receptors all the way to the biochemical cascades and down to which genes are getting expressed and which aren't. The reason that does not get incorporated into AI is because it's just hard to measure that stuff. And so what people in the AI community tend to do is just say, well, we're just going to ignore that and assume that the connection strength is everything.
Interesting. Well, before we go, while we're on the subject of AI, I have to mention that you also serve as a science consultant on one of my absolute favorite shows, HBO's Westworld. Talk about screwing with your mind. Like every time I tune into that show, yeah, I feel like it's overturning my reality. But in terms of how an artificially intelligent machine might become sentient and even develop a conscience and a moral understanding of the world, do you think that what we see happening with Dolores and Maeve and Bernard is a pretty good guess?
I actually doubt it. And here's why. I don't think we're going to build AI to be like a human. There's really no purpose of it unless you really believed that there was a business model in having an amusement park where you could go and kill robots. Right. So the thing is, if you look at the kind of machines that we build washing machines, or we build machines to tell us, map information on our phones or whatever. Like, we build things to do very specific tasks and to be good at those tasks way better than a human could. Google Maps is so much infinitely better than I am at remembering where all the streets are and what the traffic is and so on. But that's all I want it for. I don't want Google Maps to be like a human. And so it just seems really unlikely to me that there'd ever be a business model where you'd put in the millions of man hours to build something that seems just like a human. So I don't think that's the direction we're going. Right now, as a neuroscientist, it is almost impossible for me to imagine that we're going to get to a point that we even could do that in our lifetimes. By the way, for several reasons. One is that, even if AI gets better and better, which it certainly will, it's all going to be software based. There's really no point in building a robot because you always have to tend to the toilet of the robot. You know, this circuit breaks, this rusts out. It's really hard to build robots, and the whole world has gone the way of software exactly as a result of that.
Yeah. So once again, your book is called Livewired, The Inside Story of the Ever-Changing Brain. David Eagleman, wow, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to David Eagleman for coming on the show. Order his new book, Livewired, The Inside Story of the Ever-Changing Brain, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Follow David at eagleman.com or on Twitter at David Eagleman. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.